Well, good morning, Rabbi. I've already introduced you, so you can just go right ahead.
I am sorry.
We had one of our members here talking about superhero comics. So.
Great. That's not what we're talking about today. But unless you want, you know, I'm the resident rabbi at Cape and Cowell Comic Book Store. If you want to buy some comics, that's where I work. Because it's my son's new store. So if you're down in uptown Oakland, on the corner of 16th and Clay, just a block from the courthouse, you'll find the most upscale comic book store you've ever seen in your life.
The name of the store?
Cape and Cowell. I'll take off my jacket because it's warm in here, and then you can... Does it have what? It has everything. Everything. It's amazing what he does in terms of local artists and authors and people who come to speak. And I just spoke to Larry Tai, who wrote the definitive history of Superman, and he's going to come on a book tour and a book that he wrote about Bobby Kennedy, but he's going to stop at the comic book store and meet up with our comic book club. So that's just a little background. Since I last saw you, I've had two new granddaughters born. Those are numbers 2 and 3. And so I got to remind everybody that grandchildren are God's reward for not killing your children. Okay, so I can take a breath here and start. I'm going to speak today about the history of the prayer book, the Jewish prayer book called the Siddur. And it won't be as amusing as some of the other talks I've given, but it might be interesting anyway. Jewish prayer as a way of worshiping God doesn't really begin until after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. Now, there were prayers before then, but there was no prayer structure, so to speak. The most common prayer prior to that was a prayer that we call the Kaddish. The Kaddish means the sanctification. Any of you who might have grown up in a Catholic church rather than a synagogue might remember Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus. Holy, 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 right? That comes from the prophet Isaiah. And when in his vision of the throne room of God. So that was beginning of kind of worship outside the confines of the temple structure. That becomes a prayer known as the Kaddish. And the Kaddish is a prayer that sanctifies God's reign over the world. And it was so popular in the early century that there were four different iterations of it that made its way into later Jewish prayer. One of them was the Kaddish Yatom, the most famous one, which is the Mourner's Kaddish, which never mentions death, but it only sanctifies God as the God of life and the ruler of the world and to be praised. Another one was the Chatzi Kaddish, the half Kaddish. That was used as kind of a division between later parts of the service. There was the Kaddish Shalem, the complete Kaddish, which was added another verse. And then, of course, the rabbis would have a fourth one, which was called the Kaddish Derabbanan, the rabbi's Kaddish, which praised the rabbis and their students. I wonder who wrote that. But if you'd like to know what's in that prayer, without me translating it word for word for you, there's a fifth iteration that didn't make it into Jewish prayer, but is quoted by one of the rabbis of the time, who says, this is the way you should pray. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. The Lord's Prayer is the fifth version of this prayer. So if you know the Lord's Prayer, then you know what the Kaddish prayer was about. So there were prayers, per se, prior to the destruction of the temple. But the worship service is beginning to form right after there's no longer a temple to go to pray or to go to worship God. And so they began at the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, the sages who will later become the rabbis, not to be confused with the Pharisees who never were rabbis and never would be rabbis, but were a different time period, referred to a former lecture 5 or 6 years ago. I might have to do that one again someday. But so the sages began to compile an order for the prayers. And the word order is siddur, and that's the word that we use for the prayer book, is the siddur. It's the order of prayer. So they began to say that this prayer goes now, and this prayer goes, and these go together, and these don't go together, and they began to give some of the rules for the prayers. So you would think that they had a prayer book, but they didn't. So an interesting mistake, accident of history, is how we get a prayer book in the first place. See, the Jews in Spain wanted to know what's the proper way to pray. And so they sent a letter requesting information on the prayer, and they sent it from Spain to Baghdad. Now, there were two sets of powerful rabbis at the end of the first millennia. The first set was in Jerusalem, and the second set was in Babylonia, what we call Babylonia. It's really Persia, but we will always call it Babylonia because that's where we were exiled first in 586 before the Common Era. So whenever Jews talk about Babylonia, they're really talking about Persia, which is present-day Iraq, not present-day Iran. But so they wrote to Babylonia. The rabbis in Jerusalem were enraged, because the rabbis in Babylonia were famous for making rules for society and the Talmud and all sorts of laws on how to live a Jewish life. Whereas the rabbis in Jerusalem felt that they were closest to God, that they were closer to God than anybody else in the world. It's like the story that I heard back when I was in college when Nixon went to visit Golda Meir. Nixon had just spent $1 billion putting a third phone into the White House. The white phone was his regular phone. The blue phone was the red phone was the hotline directly to Moscow. And then they put in a blue phone. And the blue phone was a $1 billion phone line to God. And when he went to go visit Golda Meir, Golda only would meet him in her kitchen. This is true. She would not meet her in his office. She made him come to her kitchen where she made tea for him while she was negotiating with him. And he notices that in her kitchen there's three phones. There's a white phone, a red phone, and a blue phone. And he says, "What's going on here?" She says, "Well, the white phone's my regular phone. The red phone's the hotline directly to Cairo. And the blue phone's a direct line to God." And he said, "We give you billions of dollars of aid and you spend it on a phone to God?" And Golda Meir says, "No, from here it's a local call." So that's only half of a joke, because the rest of it is that the Jews really believe that. Okay, and therefore the rabbis who were in Jerusalem felt that they were closest to God. That if you wanted to find out about, you know, the structure of Jewish law, certainly write to Babylonia. I mean, we would like the money sent to us, but send the question to them. But if you want to know about prayer, there's no other place in the world you should write than to us. Now, but the reason that they didn't write to the rabbis in Jerusalem was quite simple, and that was the postal system. Spain was in the Islamic world, was in the Islamic Empire. Their postal system went from Spain, North Africa, Babylonia. The Jerusalem rabbis were in the European postal system, basically Rome's postal system, which was not very developed because it was the Dark Ages. They were before the Pony Express and everything. It was really bad. But in the Islamic Empire, it was really well developed. When Europe was in dark ages, and mud, and you know, everywhere, and Spain had paved roads and streetlights, so that they could see at night. So they were very advanced. The Islamic world included Jerusalem, but skipped over Jerusalem. And that's because 2 centuries before that, the caliph of Egypt, Omar, thought that he should be the caliph of the Islamic world. And so he built this magnificent structure in what was the geographic center of the Islamic world, which was Jerusalem. He cleaned up the Temple Mount that the Christians had made into a garbage dump to show that, that Judaism was had been outdated. And they saw it as a holy place, and so they cleaned it up, and he built this beautiful Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Omar. And so the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock were built in the geographic center of the Islamic world. He lost the power struggle, and the geographic center moved to Baghdad, and as a punishment, Jerusalem kind of gets ignored. Today it's the third holiest place in the Islamic world because of the Mosque of Omar and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but back then it was outside the postal system. So the rabbis in Spain send a letter to the rabbis in Baghdad, and the rabbis in Baghdad send back the order of prayer. The first one is called this Sidur of Rav Amram Gaon. The rabbis of Baghdad were known as, or the heads of the academies in Baghdad were known as Gaon, or Gaonim, plural. A Gaon, today it means genius. And really it meant the top of the academic letter. I actually would prefer the title Gaon to rabbi, but my congregation doesn't agree, so they're sticking with rabbi. So the Gaonim were considered the most academically high position you could possibly have. And so Amram Gaon sends this order of prayer to Spain. We think of that as the first Siddur, but the truth of the matter is that the prayers aren't in there, just the names of the prayers. Whereas today, you pick up a prayer book, all the words to every prayer are in here, so that everybody in the congregation can follow along with every prayer. And that has always been the kind of the source of Jewish literacy, was that in order to pray, you had to be able to read. You had to be able to read Hebrew. You didn't have to understand it, but you had to at least be able to read, which was a critical part of our history. I'll get back to that in a minute. So Amram sends out this letter, which is now published as a book, called the Order of Rav Amram. And about 100 years later, the same process happens again, this time with Sadia Gaon, the great philosopher and legalist, also from Baghdad, who sent out the Sidur of Rav Sadia Gaon. And these are lists. Now, in the lists, or sometimes, you know, the lesser-known prayers are spelled out. So some of the lesser-known prayers, you have the whole prayer. But the ones that everybody would know, they just say, well, you're going to start with the blessing for the avot, for the ancestors. And then you're going to say the blessing over God's strength, and then blessing over God's holiness. Now, those are full prayers. Each one of them has 3-4 lines and ends with a special blessing. He doesn't have to tell them that. They all know that. They have to know which one comes first, which one comes second. In his, there's a notes on when you say this prayer and when you switch over to this prayer and things like that. These notes still exist in the prayer books. So we're still praying for rain. We'll continue praying for rain until Passover, which is 2 weeks from now. And then we stop praying for rain. We pray for dew to fall and to make the crops grow. I'd never understood these prayers when I was growing up in New Jersey. They never made any sense. Why you're praying for rain in the middle of the winter? Because we didn't get any. And then I moved to Central California, and all of a sudden all the prayers were agriculturally based on exactly the same parallel and the same climate, made a lot more sense. So here in California, where you have 2 seasons instead of 4, the rainy season and the dry season, that's the way it is in the land of Israel. So for half the year you pray for rain, the other half you ask God for dew. So that's those instructions are still in the prayer book, in the Orthodox prayer book, in a Reformed prayer book. They're still there. So what's amazing, when I bought my first edition, when I was in college and I first started getting interested in prayer, I bought a copy of Sadia Gaon's prayer book in Jerusalem. And, of course, it's in Hebrew. The whole book's in Hebrew letters. And I was just learning Hebrew. I spent 2 years in Israel, and my Hebrew was getting pretty good. I could do some serious research in Hebrew. And I couldn't, every other page, I couldn't read. It had no, it seemed like I could read one page, and then the next page I couldn't. I turned the page, I could read that one, and I couldn't read the next. I had no idea what was going on until somebody finally pointed out to me that the left-hand page was in Arabic, which was the original language of it. It was written in Arabic, but in Hebrew characters. So it gave these instructions in Arabic. So the prayers would be there in Hebrew, and then the instructions would be in Arabic. So I knew where I was in the Siddur when I was reading the left-hand page, but I couldn't read the instructions. But on the right-hand side, I thought I understood the instructions. And they were, because they were the same thing, but one in Hebrew, one in Arabic. So he was, as most Jews in the Islamic Empire, they were also literate in Arabic. And Jewish philosophy, for Sadia Gaon, who was one of the first of our Jewish philosophers after Philo, he wrote his philosophy in Arabic. Maimonides, the great medieval philosopher in the 13th century, who lived in Cairo, sent his 300-page letter to his student in Arabic on the Guide to the Perplexed. So Jews in the Arab world spoke Arabic to this day. There are Jews that, when I lived in Jerusalem, the last time I lived in Jerusalem was in on my sabbatical in 88. I was living in an Iraqi neighborhood. And the Iraqi had been there for quite a while and had become very successful. And the parents got together and paid for an Arabic teacher for their elementary school, because they wanted the children in elementary school to keep the Arabic that they spoke at home going in their lives. So my daughter, who was cast into the fourth grade at that moment, learned her Hebrew when they were studying Arabic and when they were studying English, because they'd have to slow down in order to translate the words into the other languages. So that's how she picked up her Hebrew. So these Siddurim come out, and I've just rediscovered them. This past year, I've started studying the Siddur. Now, why is that? Every prayer service begins with a thank you to God. Thank you for my body. Thank you for my soul. Now it's time to study. So every prayer book has three prayers for study, and then some traditional texts that you can study. I've studied those traditional texts for 40 years now. So I decided that during that time for study, I would actually study. So I've chosen all sorts of different subjects, and this past year the subject I chose was the prayer book. And I've been studying that. I was so engaged and engrossed in my study this morning, I didn't have time to go upstairs and change into a jacket and tie. I forgot my phone. I left my notes on the desk. I was just so engrossed in going over one of the prayers that I was looking for the history of that prayer in the Cairo Geniza. What's the Cairo Geniza? The Cairo Geniza is a place where the Jews of Cairo would put any worn-out books that had God's name in it. They wouldn't throw them away. They put them in a special room, and that special room is called the Geniza, a hidden-away room. And that room was rediscovered at the end of the 19th century by Solomon Schechter, when he saw a door, or heard about it, saw a door that was up, I think it's been described as 15 or 18 feet up. Not any way, no staircase, no nothing, just a door. So they had a ladder that, if I understand correctly, the ladder was 12 feet. And the room was 15 feet or 18 feet, I don't remember. But Solomon Schechter had to pull himself up and sit on the door frame, and then for the whole way down were papers. Okay, from every age since the city of old Cairo, old Fostat, had been populated by Jews. And so he literally loaded himself in and started picking through the papers and finding the ones that were interesting to him. Later, scholars will go in there. One of them, Solomon Goitheim, is a scholar of Arabic. And he went in and grabbed all the Arabic business papers that had been placed in there by the Jewish community. Didn't want to throw those away. They wouldn't even throw away the pieces of paper that were business lists. And so he's written many volumes, fascinating volumes, about the business practices of the Jewish community in the early second millennia, because these were the documents that were stored there. Solomon Schechter found in these, among the Geniza, copies of the original or nearly original Siddur of Rav Avraham Gaon, Sadia Gaon, Maimonides' prayer book. All these pieces are there, pieces of the Talmud that were that had been guessed. Works that we would eventually verify when we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. The amazing thing is, here you have these documents now from the early second millennia, and the documents from the beginning of the first millennia, and they're the same. The prayer, the Torah hasn't changed, the prophets haven't changed, and the prayers have not changed that dramatically. But, and here's the amazing part. So I started studying the prayers. What fascinated me was, I had grown up in with the name Manhoff in a German Reform congregation back east. Everything was proper. Everything was exactly on time. If the service was called for 8:05, my rabbi was on the pulpit at the microphone at 8:05. We walked in the door at 8:04, walked up the, and it was exactly on time. Everything was. So I always assumed that I was a European Ashkenazi Jew. Manhoff sounds very much like Hoffman, which is clearly a German name. My father's family has been in this country at least since the Civil War, because we have Manhoffs who were buried in Dubuque, Iowa, in the 1860s. Okay, my father's great-grandfather was the chief of police in Dubuque, Iowa, who was married to the sheriff's sister. So in the 1860s, the sheriff and the chief of police in Dubuque were both Jewish. There were three synagogues in Dubuque, Iowa. And my great-great-great-great-grandfather was the lay leader of the third one before they got a rabbi. That's the closest in my family you get to rabbis. The rest of my family are coaches and teachers. My family was there then, and most European Jews came at the end of the end of the 19th century, and before World War II in the 20th century, then maybe my father's claim that we were descended from one of the great war heroes of the Revolutionary War, Chaim Solomon, who was one of the great financiers of the, my father said we were related to them. We had cousins whose name were Solomon, and so he said we were related to them. My father was a great storyteller. Nobody really accepted that. Chaim Solomon was Sephardic. It just didn't add up until 23andMe. You know, 23andMe is where you can check your genome. So I checked my genome about 2 years ago, and son of a gun, if my mother's genome is in Ashkenazi, my grandfather was born in Russia, but my father's genome is Middle Eastern Sephardic. And so I decided, now I'm going to pray as a Sephardic Jew. From now on, I'm going to start praying as the Spanish Jews prayed, because that's what Sephardic means, Spanish. So I got a Sephardic prayer book, and I started praying from that. I went to one of my colleagues, and I told him I wanted to learn some of the traditions of the Sephardic Jews. When do you stand? When do you sit? Et cetera, et cetera. He said, now, are you Spanish Sephardic, or are you Middle Eastern Sephardic? So I didn't realize that. So it turns out my genome says I'm Middle Eastern Sephardic and not Spanish, right? I'm not from Europe. I'm from the Middle East. So I got a different prayer book. Okay. And so I started praying from that prayer book. Now, that prayer book is very different than the prayer book from Ashkenaz, and even different in some ways from the Spanish Sephardic traditions as well. And now I'm really confused. Besides, well, in those days when I was in a rush, I'd pick up the Reform prayer book, and I could do this morning service from the Reform prayer book with my tallit, the prayer shawl, and my tefillin, the phylacteries, right, the straps that you put on. And I could do it with the Reform prayer book. It would take me 20 minutes instead of a half an hour if I used the Orthodox prayer book. So now I'm using four different prayer books. And they're all different. They're all the same. They're all in the same order. They all have basically the same prayers, but the words aren't the same. How did that happen? So that's how I got started studying a year ago, started studying the tefillah. I've gone through the prayer books, and I now mark the in colors where they're different, where the words are completely different, that's in orange, and that's in green. When the words are added in one book but not in another book, then that's in orange. If it's like one of the other books but it's not in this book, that's blue. And so my Siddurim are now color-coded so that I don't make the mistake when I get to that part of the service. I know I've got to be careful and pay attention and not just read right through it. So how did that happen? Well, I just told you where the two first prayer books came from, and now I have copies of those. I have printed editions of the Siddur of Rav Amram, and I have a Siddur of Rav Sadia, and I open those up, and then I start comparing them to the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic. And now I have a notebook that's full of these comparisons. This morning, I read in one of the commentaries that there was this prayer was different in the Geniza, and I spent an hour of my half an hour study time looking for an article that would tell me exactly what were the words in the Geniza, and I found the article, and then I got so absorbed in the article, the time got away from me, and I'm still waiting to do my morning prayers. So how does it happen? How does it happen that all these are different? Well, so the Sephardic tradition has grown from these two different basic communities, from the community that stayed in the Islamic world and from the community that went to Spain when it was in the Islamic world and ended up getting expelled in 1492 by the Católicos throughout the you know, we call it the Jewish expulsion. The truth of the matter is they were expelling the Muslims and the Jews had to go with them because the Jews and the Muslims had ruled together. I should say the Muslims had ruled with Jewish help and got along with Christians. When the Christians took over and the Catholics took over again, they expelled the Muslims. The Jews had to go also. Where did the Jews go? Some of them went back to Istanbul, Turkey and that part of the world, but most of them went up to Amsterdam, one of the few places in the world where Jews are welcome. So they brought their Islamic Spanish tradition to the Ashkenazi world of the Netherlands and that part of the world. And so that's how that Sephardic tradition begins to become different than the other. Now, some of those Jews went to Italy, right across the water there. It was a safe spot for them. And so they went there and remember that they're there. Okay, remember that there's Spanish Sephardic Jews in Italy. Because during the time period of the Gaonim, remember when I said the postal system connected Jerusalem to Rome, right? So most of the Jews would be under what we call the Palestinian influence of the synagogues or the rabbis in Jerusalem, which is a completely different religious tradition. So their prayer book is called the Roman prayer book, the prayer book of Rome. And it's probably the oldest, the least changed of all the prayer books. And nobody uses it. It's just not in use anymore. Okay, moving on. You with me so far?
Yeah.
You know, my students at St. Mary's will ask me, do I have to know this? I said, yes, you have to know it all. Okay. Right. So the prayer books, now I have three prayer books in front of me, four if you include the Reform prayer book, and I'm looking at all the differences. Where did the differences come from? So the Jews of the Islamic world made the least number of changes. The Sephardic prayer book is a kind of a blend between the Middle Eastern Sephardic Jews and the Ashkenazi Jews. The Roman prayer book is a pure Jerusalem tradition. Okay, the prayer book that then spreads into Israel, into Europe, is what we call the Ashkenazi tradition. Ashkenaz is the Hebrew word for Germany. It's really the dominant Jewish community of early European history was the Rhine Valley. That community was completely wiped out by the Crusades. There was nothing left. We have like two documents left from that time period. It moves quickly to France, where you have Rashi, and then it moves to back to the Rhineland, back, and then finally across to Poland, and then to Europe, and then to Russia. Okay, so that's the Ashkenazi tradition that we have. The first printed prayer book with prayers in it was in France, in Vitry. And the first prayer book was not printed for the Sabbath or for daily worship, but only for the high holy days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Why would you need that prayer book before you needed a daily prayer book? Because you only did it once a year. So they weren't as well known, right? So they needed all the words for these special prayers that were for those two special days of the year. And so that was the first prayer book that was ever printed in Jewish history. When the printing press is invented, with movable type, right after the Gutenberg press, the Jews begin setting up press in Italy, in Amsterdam, in Istanbul, etc., etc. So and then you'll finally get prayer books, and before that you get the Talmud, and then you get Bibles, and then the prayer books. The prayer books of Europe stay pretty much the same now until you get the Hasidic movement. The Hasidim was kind of the first anti-intellectual movement in our history, where you could praise God by dancing and singing, and it didn't really matter if you knew the words, etc., etc. The Baal Shem Tov was this great storyteller. He went around, and this is the early 18th century, right? And he's going around and he's healing people. His story is very similar to Jesus' story. He's going around telling stories, teaching by example, teaching by story, healing, writing amulets, the same kind of thing. And he was not a scholar. Second generation of his followers, the people who become his disciples, who then go out and found these great Hasidic empires, which is what they are even to this day, were rabbis. So this anti-intellectual movement lasted a generation, and then it became a rabbinic scholarly movement. They wanted a prayer book that was more mystical, more Zohar-related, more Kabbalah-related. Not that anybody could study the Kabbalah. So they got a version of the prayer book that was closest to the Spanish Kabbalist, the prayer book that went to Rome from Spain. So their prayer book now goes back to the ancient Palestinian tradition in Eastern Europe, whereas the rest of Europe is using the Ashkenazi tradition. It's probably the newest of all the traditions. The Sephardic traditions are splitting between those who stayed behind in the Middle East and those who have come to Spain and therefore came to the rest of the world. And today you can get prayer books from every one of these communities. Every one of them has slightly different wording. Everyone has slightly different instructions. And then in modern times, the beginning of the modern reform movement, the first liberal movement, not the first, the liberal movement to which I am part of now, their first thing was to take a prayer book that looked like this and cut it down to something that looked like this. Okay, they began to shorten the service, a service which takes two hours or 3 hours on the Sabbath can now be done in an hour in the Reformed tradition. And the first thing they began doing was taking out some of the medieval poetry that was no longer understood by anybody, including the Orthodox Jews. And they began changing some of the theological points. You won't find very many theological changes in the early prayer books, except for statements about the role of the Messiah, the hope for the Messiah, Jerusalem. Needless to say, the prayer books from Jerusalem were much more Jerusalem-oriented, and the prayer books from other places had other influences. And so the Reform movement, for example, changed the prayer from resurrection to the dead to the one who brings all life instead of... So that was like a major change, and everybody gets all upset about that, and then it's the same thing that went on for history. So the Reform movement, interestingly, changed its prayer book. You know, with this, I'll end with one little story about the congregation where I'm now at Beth Sholem. When I got to Temple Beth Sholem in San Leandro, they thought they were a conservative congregation. I say they thought they were a conservative congregation, and I'm a Reform rabbi, but they decided that maybe I could be their rabbi anyway. And they've never had, they didn't know this, but they've never had a conservative rabbi. It's 120 years old. They've never had a conservative rabbi. The rabbi who picked the conservative prayer book was a German refugee, a German Reform rabbi by the name of Rabbi Zucker. In the 1940s, the late 1940s, the Reform prayer book was almost all English with a couple of prayers in Hebrew. But Rabbi Zucker spoke German and French, and he spoke, and he read Hebrew, and he read Aramaic. English was his fifth language. Why in the world would he pray to God in English? So he chose a liberal Hebrew prayer book, which was the conservative prayer book, the prayer book of the conservative movement, the middle ground movement. And since they used a Hebrew prayer book, they thought they were conservative. I keep kosher, they don't. I observe all the holidays for 2 days. They don't. I mean, I'm more conservative than they are, and the only reason that they thought they were conservative is they used a conservative prayer book because Rabbi Zucker didn't want to pray in English. He wanted to pray in Hebrew.
Rabbi Manhoff, we only have a couple minutes left, and we don't have time for questions today. So.
Oh, I thought the 5 minutes gave me time for questions. Oh, that's not fair. Okay, so I will stay around. If any of you have questions, I always am always happy to talk to you, and I apologize profusely for getting here late.
Well, thank you for coming anyway.